Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. From many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's July the 8th, 2010. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. A few quick opening comments here. Last week, I detected the first sign of actual hostile surveillance of this Radio Free Northwest podcast series. And by that, I don't mean from individual Jews and idiots. I mean from a semi-official body, specifically the Anti-Defamation League, which has both the power and the will to do harm. An incident occurred, which I won't get into because it's possible that this wasn't deliberate and that one of the ADL guys made a for-real slip, and if he slipped up, I don't want to tip off whoever's listening on behalf of Abe Foxman to that fact. But this gets us back to the question of, at what point does legitimate security consciousness become paranoia, and at what point does it begin to interfere with our operation to the point where we have to say just to hell with it and let the chips fall where they may? Now, we've had the odd Jew and lefty dipshit listening to these podcasts ever since they started back in January, I know, because after every one, they send me stupid emails and make silly little heckling comments on the blogs, all of which I ignore. Although I confess I did send one sarky reply to an idiot who doesn't know the difference between Peter Townshend and Graham Nash. But I've always assumed that everything I do on the internet is monitored by the government, not out of paranoia, but because I know it from first-hand experience. In September of 2001, I was living in Texas, and I was working for a computer tech support company. We supplied tech support for an ISP software called Spinway. Does anyone remember that brief couple of years around the turn of the millennium when Kmart and Costco and some other people were providing their own internet access, giving away those crummy free software CDs in their stores? Well, they were using Spinway software, and when the problems developed, as they always did with that piece of crap, and you call for tech support, you might have gotten me on the line. Anyway, about 3 weeks after 9/11, all of a sudden one night in our call center in College Station, every Aspect phone and every monitor and every board lit up like a Christmas tree with thousands of calls jamming the call center. Nobody could get through on their Blue Light or Costco or iOne or whatever Spinway freebie they were using. To make a long story short, the FBI had just installed a carnivore email monitoring system on every ISP in the country. Earthlink, Mindspring, AOL, whatever. But they hadn't quite got it right, and in the case of Blue Light or other users, there was some kind of clash between the carnivore and the servers in San Francisco, San Jose, wherever they were, I forget. Anyway, the servers wouldn't authenticate passwords, so nobody could sign on. Eventually, this was explained to us by the company, and we were given a little sheet to read to the irate customers on the phone, explaining it all away. Needless to say, we didn't tell them the truth, which was that Juggy Ears and his little Jewish friends had seized on a national disaster in order to set up Big Brother. I can't remember what the excuse we gave them was. Anyway, in about a week, the FBI's computer people were able to fix the software glitch, and all of our customers could get connected again. So I know for a fact that from about October of 2001 onward, the FBI has at least had the technical capability to monitor all the email in the country. How much of it they're monitoring, and where and why and who and for what purpose, I've no idea. I've already made it clear that from our point of view, we have no real choice but to accept as a fact of life that we're being watched. And really, the only thing we can do is just ignore it, make sure we don't do or say anything really stupid that just begs for us to be arrested, and drive on. Of course, they define the legal parameters of what's acceptable, and those parameters seem to be getting narrower and narrower as Obongo and his Jew crew get more and more nervous. We have to communicate, though, and as long as we refuse to live in communities within half an hour's drive of each other, and we insist on living completely isolated from one another by hundreds and thousands of miles, we have no choice but to communicate with these machines. The problem is that for most of us, the personal computer is not a form of communication. It's a way to escape from reality that allows us to avoid the real world and live in a kind of fantasy. Now, on to another topic. I've long been derided and mocked and sneered at by all the internuts out there because I believe that at some point in time, we are going to lose the internet. No one out there believes me, I know, but more and more, the daily news is beginning, well, if not exactly to prove me right, then it's pretty sinister. In essence, what the Jews and liberals and Democrats seem to be doing is using the old communist salami slicer technique, wherein the rights of a subject people are sliced away thin slice by thin slice. Now, last week, Congress passed a law, in essence giving the President of the United States, i.e. that worthless nigger Barry Satoru, a legal kill switch, whereby in the event of a so-called national emergency, he has the power to restrict, shut down, or take offline all or part of the internet. And the question is, who gets to define what constitutes a national emergency? Well, Barry does, which basically means Rahm Emanuel, David Axelrod, Cass Sunstein, and all the other Jew crew in the White House. Or possibly our nigger Attorney General, Eric Holder, the same one who's suing Arizona for enforcing immigration law. Or maybe the Supreme Court, overrun with left-wing Jew and Marxist bitches like Elena Kagan, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and Sonia Sotomayor. Today, there was another article to the effect that Transportation Safety Agency employees may no longer access websites with quote-unquote controversial opinions, i.e. Matt Drudge and Glenn Beck, possibly because their minds might become corrupted with forbidden right-wing thought and they might turn into mad airplane hijackers. But then there was the revelation about 8 months ago of Cass Sunstein's so-called cognitive dissonance operations, whereby paid government agents infiltrate selected websites and bulletin boards and the comments sections of newspapers on certain articles, and they deliberately disrupt discussion, cause dissension and turmoil, and generally act like loons in order to blow off serious people. Now, this cognitive dissonance thing might actually be worthy of a whole separate discussion in itself. Have you ever wondered exactly why so many people who show up on our internet bulletin boards and forums seem to be deliberately looking for a fight or deliberately behaving in such a way as to blow off any serious person who reads their drivel, seemingly doing their level best to undermine a cause that they claim to believe in and support? I think we've all suspected that some of these disruptors may be so-called Jew agents, and when we say this, everyone thinks we've flipped out into paranoia land. And yet, there it was in black and white last year, Cass Sunstein's grinning Jew mug in the article about his cognitive dissonance program to disrupt the internet discussion on any site opposing Obama and the Democrats. Remember, just because you're paranoid don't mean they ain't out to get you. Getting back to the topic at hand, the real-world fact is that we have to use computers, we have to use cell phones. And even other forms of communication like ham radio and CB are susceptible to monitoring and interception by the regime. On the few occasions when I have anything to say that's genuinely confidential, I put it in the form of a letter, slap a stamp on it, and drop it in the mail. That's slow, and I know we've all gotten used to the lightning speed of email and Skype, but it's a lot more secure. I want to put the FBI to the trouble of doing a good old-fashioned mail cover. I think they still have to have a warrant to open a first-class letter, but then again, apparently not under the Patriot Act. That seems to be a bit of a gray area. I've been told that all that's necessary now is for a U.S. attorney to declare a specific investigation, a so-called terrorist case, and the whole Constitution legally ceases to exist. Anyway, I want to make the FBI start doing mail covers again. Those assholes are getting too lazy sitting there in their cubicles playing with their computers. I want to make them get up out of their seats and drive through traffic and deal with stupid postal workers in order to steal an envelope from the mail, not to mention make them do all the paperwork that a mail cover requires. I know they don't need a warrant anymore under the Patriot Act, but still, they have to file a lot of internal documentation, and I want to make make them earn their salaries and their medical insurance. Now, it seems to me I've gone over all this before on this program, so I'll stop rambling now and get on to the first email. Actually, I received several emails from different people, all to the following effect. Dear HAC, did you hear that Mel Gibson was recorded using the N-word on a telephone message to his Russian girlfriend? Could he possibly be of any use to us? First off, what exactly is the N-word? You mean nigger. When you want to say nigger, say nigger. Don't say N-word. N-word is what the Jews and niggers and liberals want you to say. I see N-word even on so-called racialist sites, and that's ridiculous. The word you're looking for is nigger, although I admit I can't say it with as much feeling as Jim Giles can. Yes, I heard that Mel Gibson was recorded on his girlfriend's answering machine saying nigger, although I'm sorry to hear that he ran off and left his wife and seven children for some Ruskaya Krasiva. One of the big things Gibson always had going for him in a lot of people's book was his image as a wholesome family man, one of the few in Hollywood who did have that image. I suppose that after he was more or less blacklisted by the Jewish entertainment industry and denied the right to work, or at least to work on any project worthy of his talents, he fell prey to what the French call le démon du midi, the demon of the afternoon, which is a kind of male menopause that causes middle-aged men to try and recapture their lost youth by running off chasing young women and making public spectacles out of themselves. Me, when I turned 40, I made a private vow to myself that one thing I would never do would be to make a fool out of myself over some girl young enough to be my daughter. So, needless to say, the first thing I did was run out and make a fool of myself over a woman my own age, but we won't get into that. As to whether Mel Gibson could be of any use to the racial or Northwest Nationalist cause, when this happened, I did send out an email to the list to the effect that since Mel Gibson is now on record as using the forbidden N-word, and he's therefore complete Hollywood toast from now on, I'd like to strike while the iron is hot and see if I can get him a copy of The Brigade, along with the following suggestion. Dear Mel, this is twice now you've been caught using forbidden words. Now that you're Hollywood toast and your career is total history, I'd like to ask you to read the enclosed novel. And if you're pissed off enough at the Jews and lefties who run Hollywood and who've screwed you over so bad, may I suggest that you use the last of your considerable personal fortune to finance and produce a movie out of The Brigade as one final flip of the bird to the Hollywood establishment. Go out with a bang, Mel, not with a whimper. Trouble is, for that I need a mailing address where I can be reasonably sure to get the package containing the book right into his own hands, and not some flunky or secretary or agency. A very few celebrities ever hit rock bottom so bad that they open their own mail. It's been suggested that I try to get to Gibson either through his father, who was known to be a Holocaust revisionist, and also through the small Tridentine Catholic sect that the Gibsons belong to, although since the Tridentines still go for all that Christian stuff about no adultery and all, I don't know how they feel about Mel's disorderly love life and running off and leaving his family for the Russian girl, with whom I'm told he also has a child now. Anyway, maybe some of you hotshot internet search engine whizzes out there can see if you can come up with anything. The thing is, would it do any good? I kind of question that because, as I mentioned last week, I'm very skeptical of this idea that we seem unable to shake, and that is that somehow our salvation will come from within the system, either the political system or within Hollywood. We crave, we long for somebody within the system, some celebrity, to get up and affirm us in public, to tell us that we're right. We have that much self-doubt, apparently, because we have been socially engineered all our lives not to think for ourselves, but to pay attention to whoever the media tells us to pay attention to. People who, more often than not, are vapid, shallow airheads like Lindsay Lohan. I mean, Jesus, Lindsay Lohan? If she were to come up for air during one of her drug or booze-induced hazes long enough to say something mildly critical of the Jews, we'd probably be proclaiming her to be some kind of leader or prophet. We want that man on the white horse so bad. Anyone from within the establishment who will step forward and tell us that, yes, we were right all along and he'll take it from here. He will do it all for us. We can watch it all on TV. We won't ever have to get up from behind our computers. We won't ever have to leave the house. We won't have to move anywhere. We won't have to incur any risk or danger or even inconvenience. And above all, we will never have to forcibly confront the United States government and its armed men. Sure, every now and then some politician or some movie star or other celebrity will let slip some politically incorrect remark, usually about the Jews. I mean, it's not as if these celebrity and political people don't know about the kikes. Hell, they know the Jews better than anybody else because they work with them and see them close up, closer than other people, especially in Hollywood. And especially when they're drunk or stoned or even more in this day and age when you never know if you're being recorded on a video cam or something, sometimes the dangerous remarks just kind of slip out of their mouths. And you notice what always happens. The celebrity, whoever has made the gaffe, tries to come crawling back on their bellies, their tails thumping between their legs and pissing on the floor like a whipped dog, begging for readmittance into the Golden Medina, as the Jews call their America. I suspect that Mel Gibson will probably try something of the kind, although it didn't work for him the first time. Since they never forgave him for using the J word, I don't see how they'll ever let him off the hook on using the N word. My God, did you hear that? The liberal bastards have got me doing it now. Just shows how powerful their social engineering is. Let me rephrase that. Since Gibson has already said Jew out loud, I don't see them letting him off the hook on saying nigger. And my guess is that if ever I were able to confront Mel Gibson with my idea that he make a movie out of the Brigade in order to send one last giant fuck you to the Hollywood establishment, he'd probably scream in horror and start running and never stop until he hit the Pacific Ocean down in Malibu. Still, what the hell? If anybody can come up with some kind of reliable mailing address where there's at least some likelihood that Mel himself will open the package and not some secretary or flunky, let me know. I'm willing to risk a Brigade copy on it. I mean, at least Gibson might find it an amusing relief from all his troubles. Okay, first music break. In 1524, the peasants of Germany rose in armed revolt against the nobility, the Catholic Church, the Jews, and their crushing taxes. Their leader was a former shoemaker named Thomas Münzer, but many of the minor nobility joined them, including a knight from Franconia named Florian Geyer. Geyer organized the cavalry wing of the rebel peasant army, and they were called the Schwarze Corps because Geyer outfitted his riders with black clothing and armor. German soldiers in black? Where have we heard that before? The peasants succeeded for a while in driving most of the nobles and priests out of large sections of Germany, but in 1525 Münzer's army was defeated, and Münzer himself was killed at the Battle of Frankenhausen. Florian Geyer was able to escape with a fragment of the army and occupy the town and castle of Ingolstadt, but he and his men were surrounded there, and after an epic siege, Geyer was also defeated and killed in battle. But his memory has lived on among the people of Germany, and over the centuries, he's become a national hero. During the Second World War, the 8th SS Division was nicknamed the Florian Geyer Division. Now, this is an old German folk song commemorating Geyer and the last stand of the peasant rebels, which was also played and sung by the SS on the Eastern Front. The title is Wir sind des Geyers Schwarze Haufen, which loosely translated means We are Geyer's Warriors in Black.
Spieß voran, drauf und ran, setz es aufs Klosterdach den roten Hahn. Spieß voran, drauf und dran, setzt aufs Klosterdach den roten Hahn. Bei Weinsberg setzt es Rand und Stank, hei-ja-o, gar mancher über die Klinge sprang, hei-ja-o. Spieß voran, drauf und dran, setzt aufs Klosterdach den roten Hahn. Spieß voran, drauf und dran, setzt aufs Klosterdach den roten Hahn. Geschlagen ziehen wir nach Haus, hei-ja-o, unsere Enkel fechten's besser aus, hei-ja-o. Spieß voran, drauf und dran, setzt aufs Klosterdach den roten Hahn. Spieß voran, drauf und dran, setzt aufs Klosterdach den roten Hahn.
Okay, next up, from Clay in Salt Lake City, dear HAC, I'd like to hear some discussion about European cultural revival in the future Northwest homeland. One of the most disheartening things about living in America today is that most whites have adopted a consumer-oriented cheeseburger with fries mindset, and they have no knowledge of their roots or the cultural traditions that their ancestors brought to the New World. I think such traditions are important to create a strong community in the new homeland. What sorts of cultural practices would you envision in the future Northwest? Well, I got into the subject a little in The Hill of the Ravens, which was set in the future Northwest American Republic, and of course I can get into it a lot more if I ever do find the time to write that fifth Northwest novel, which, as I've said before, would be a kind of ongoing history of the first 50 years or so of the Republic, as seen through the eyes of a few key characters and families whom I would follow through their lives from their youth at the time of the Revolution into their old age. As with so much in this rotten toilet we live in, before we can discuss this from a positive point of view, we have to discuss it from a negative point of view. Life, the economy, culture, and education in the Northwest Republic will be distinguished not only for what it contains, but for what it does not contain. There will be no black or brown or hook-nosed faces on the streets, on TV, in film, anywhere. Having lived in an all-white society myself in Ireland in the 1980s, I can tell you that the mere absence of niggers and spics will make every other problem the Republic has worth it all. You have no idea how wonderful it is to be surrounded by nobody but white people. I think in the Northwest Republic, our health problems due to stress and high blood pressure would virtually disappear. There will be no booga booga rap music or blaring salsa on the streets or anywhere else. There will be no homosexual perversion, either in real life or in the media or arts or entertainment. I suppose there'll always be a few people who'll go off and do these acts in private, but when that kind of thing is detected, it will be treated as a form of mental illness, which is what it is, because the people who engage in it get off on pain and bodily degradation. They will be confined in mental institutions and treated, if possible, but the whole subject will once again become taboo. I didn't even know what a homosexual was until I joined the army at age 17. During my childhood, the entire topic was never mentioned. It didn't even exist. And that's how things should be. There will be no crushing taxes in the Northwest American Republic. No constant government regulation interfering with a man's right to earn a living through his own hard work and creativity. Now, while we'll have a free enterprise system, which as far as I'm concerned would allow for a restaurant owner to serve whatever kind of food he likes, I somehow don't think there'll be too many taco joints, Mexican restaurants, Chinese takeaways. And if there are, they'll be run by white people. By the by, most ethnic food in America these days isn't the real McCoy anyway. It's some kind of American variation that's loaded up with too much salt and cholesterol and greasy meat. For example, have you ever tasted a genuine Italian pizza, the one they actually eat in Italy? It's quite delicious, but it's almost completely meatless, and it bears no resemblance to what you get from Domino's. The same thing goes for Mexican and Chinese food. That's not what the natives actually eat in Mexico and China. The actual Mexicans and Chinese Chinese who live there eat real crap. I can tell you that the Vietnamese live on nothing but rice and a god-awful fish sauce called Nước Mắm because that's all they can afford. I'm sorry, I'm rambling off topic again. Anyway, you'll be amazed what effect the complete absence of non-whites and Jews and their negative influence will have on the development of culture and society in the Northwest Republic. We will combine that absence of Jewish and Negroid contamination with genuine diversity, white diversity. We will be a nation of white immigrants as large portions of the remaining white populations of Britain, Ireland, South Africa, Australia, and the rest of North America flee to the Northwest Republic for safety for themselves and their families. And we will eventually produce our own strong hybrid nation made out of a unification of all the strands of the Aryan family of peoples. An ingathering of the folk, the first in all the millennia since we began that long migration from the shores of Lake Baikal I spoke of last week. What began in the forests of Russia thousands of years ago will come full circle here in the Northwest. The Northwest Republic will be the fifth racially conscious white nation in modern history after the Southern Confederacy, the Third Reich, Rhodesia, and South Africa. But like the Third Reich, we will be specifically race conscious per se, without all the confused fuzziness and obscure thought and shades of gray involved in wrapping race consciousness into cocoons of such issues as capitalism, democracy, and Christianity, as we had in the South and in Africa. In the mix of our Northwest Republic will be customs, music, cuisine, traditions, folklore, and national characteristics from all of our historic nations and cultures, from Sweden to South Carolina. In The Hill of the Ravens, I spoke of such things as arranged marriages and archaic dress, with the men wearing things like fedoras and cuffed trousers from the 1930s. And when I had my two boss agents going to the high school to interview the one teacher who was an NVA veteran, I described how the male students were wearing pinstripe jackets and straw boaters, and the girls were wearing long dresses and buttoned boots and leg of mutton sleeves from the 1890s. Personally, that's something I'd like to see. I do believe that to a large extent, clothes make the man or the woman. Maybe this is wishful thinking or an attempt at sympathetic magic, but I think that adopting the fashions and dress code of earlier eras will encourage earlier forms of thought and outlook. And besides, I just happen to think the older fashions look better, but maybe that's just Harold being eccentric. Now, in the 19th and early 20th century, with our so-called melting pot here in America, for a brief time we created something kind of like this until we started throwing black and brown and Jewish excrement into the melting pot, and it melted down into a gooey, sickening mess. But you can have a melting pot which can produce a whole new nation, an alloy, an amalgam that can be much stronger than the original components, so long as you use iron and steel and bronze to make that alloy and don't try to mix in goat droppings and dead rats. What I predict a century from now is a Northwest Republic that is, for all intents and purposes, a new Aryan nation on the face of the earth. Up until now, the Afrikaners have been the youngest child of our racial family of nations. We will become that. Once someone asked me, what would we be called as a nation? Northwest Republicans? Northwesters? What? Me, I would like to think that the rest of the world would just call us Northmen and leave it at that. One of the great curses of our people has always been that we have never considered ourselves to be white people. We always think of ourselves as Polish or Italian or Irish or English, or in some cases as Catholic or Baptist or as Southerners or Californians or New Yorkers. We missed out on the greatest national and ethnic identity of them all, our race. That is one area where the blacks and the mestizos have it all over us. They instinctively recognize their race first, and any other national or tribal traits is purely secondary. A Zulu or a Maasai or an Igbo will refer to himself as an African first, by which he means a black person. A mestizo Hispanic is never primarily a Mexican or a Puerto Rican or a Guatemalan. He is first and foremost a member of La Raza, the race. A Muslim of any race is a Muslim first, or at least a Shiite or a Sunni first, and not an Iraqi or a Saudi or a Yemenite, whatever. Ironically, I have known white South Americans who considered themselves to be Argentinians or Chileans or Costa Ricans first, not a member of their race. Purely national primary self-identification seems to be a purely white phenomenon. We are the only people on earth who do not think of ourselves as a race. Okay, I know I'm doing it again. I'm wandering off the subject of the original question. Okay, long and short of it, Clay, is that cultural life in the Northwest Republic will have to be a kind of a salvage operation to a large extent because we have lost so much. It'll be like dredging a sunken shipwreck looking for treasure. We're going to have to suck up a lot of sludge and mud and filter it for the gold doubloons and the jewels in it. And as in my novel, we'll probably need some kind of government ministry as well as help from a lot of our own NGOs to help in that dredging and sifting process. It's a very exciting prospect, and I really hope that my pessimistic outlook is incorrect, and I really do live to see us begin this incredible project of restoring a soul and an identity to an entire race. I think I'd love to work in that particular department more than any other. Unfortunately, we have this annoying little revolution thing we have to get through first. Okay, on we go. Mike from Pennsylvania writes, "Hello, Mr. Covington. Thank you for posting the Radio Free Northwest series, for all you have done for our people. I have a question I would like to ask that's been on my mind for some time now. I am an older brother of three younger siblings. Two of them are 8 and 10 years old, and I always seek to do what I can to be a good influence on them. My question is, what is an effective way to educate younger generations about racial issues? The education system, the television, and every other mainstream medium in our society promotes multicultural nonsense and tolerance that will teach younger generations to despise who they are. This is unacceptable, but if I make an honest effort to try and make them aware of how they're being deceived, it may just frighten them or make me seem like a bad guy, because after all, it's my word against the rest of society's. Any advice you have on this issue will be greatly appreciated. What are we supposed to do?" Okay, you have the same problems with siblings that a lot of parents have with their children. I need to preface my remarks here by reminding those of you who don't know that my own children were taken away from me when they were very young, and when I got back to this country, I never had the time and money to get married again and try to start over. So I've never had the chance to do this myself. Therefore, I may not be precisely the right man to ask, but here goes. I think the key to raising a child successfully, especially instilling proper racial values, is to do it right from the start. Never underestimate the importance of starting with a child as young as possible. I'd say the first 2 years are crucial. A happy and well-adjusted baby makes a happy and well-adjusted toddler, then a happy and well-adjusted kindergartner, and so forth and so on. The home should be a safe and happy place for a very young child, free of any obvious stress and tension between the parents, materially comfortable in that he or she is always properly dressed and changed and fed. A child remembers things like being cold and hungry and having a dirty diaper and a lot of yelling and loud things going on, even if not specifically in later life. It messes with his mind and it starts him off with some bad things in his head. And when a child gets older, you need to make sure that he or she likes you and respects you as a person so that they'll want to please you and be like you. Now, children naturally seek the approval of adults. Make sure that the child wants your approval. That having been said, this liberal business about how you gotta be the child's best friend is crap. You're not there to be a friend or to serve the child's self-esteem. You are there to teach them and shape them and make them into the kind of man or woman they're going to be. Now, there has to be love in the relationship, absolutely, no argument there. But the parent-child relationship is largely one of duty and responsibility on the parent's part. You have a job to do and you can never allow yourself to forget it. And remember, again, contrary to all this hippy-dippy liberal horseshit, the child does not know what's good for him or her. The child, by definition, doesn't know anything at all. They're a child. It is your job to make sure that they know what they need to know and that what they know is right. Insofar as is feasible, you need to control what the child takes in by way of knowledge and experience, although I know in this society that's damn near impossible. I think it's why so many white racial people have this tendency to want to move way out into the piney woods with some kind of cabin and no television and no liberal crap pounding down all around their children. Although I've already said I think we need to establish our primary settlement areas here in the Northwest where there are people and where we can build a movement that will one day confront the enemy rather than hide from him. Don't worry, I get it when parents tell me that their main motivation for selecting the locality and living the way they do is to protect their children from the liberal and the Jewish poison. I can't really argue with that, except to repeat that in the long run, we have to plan for confrontation rather than flight or evasion, because we will not be allowed to withdraw from the PC world, and if we try, eventually the enemy will come looking for us, like they came looking for Randy Weaver and John Singer and the Branch Davidians and those polygamists down in Texas. But that's a whole nother subject. We've gone over that one before, and we'll go over it again, just not now. As far as the racial education of a child goes, that's a subject we really can go on and on about, and perhaps it might be a good one for some of our listeners who are doing that very thing to contribute their own thoughts on. Now, remember what I said last week about wanting to get some more voices besides my own on here? Now, if you guys can send me an MP3 recording, 5 to 7 minutes in length, I'll see if I can get it on during the next few broadcasts, or failing that, you can write a long email and I can read it out. Although it would be better if people actually heard your voice talking about these things. My own bit of advice for now is to try and raise the child on older stuff. Books and movies which were made in the days before political correctness. Early Walt Disney stuff, etc., etc. One of the formative influences in my own childhood was a 6-volume series of illustrated storybooks that had belonged to my mother when she was a child. They were published in the 1920s and they were called My Book House. And there were all kinds of fascinating stories in there dealing to a large extent with white history and white culture. Plus, the illustrations were very good. They gave me a vision of a white past. These books are completely out of print now, of course, and I keep hoping that one of these conservative or homeschooling associations will reprint them. I tell you what, how about we hear from some parents who are homeschooling their children, and let's see how they're going about it. Now, like I said, you can either send me a written account by email, or better yet, an MP3 audio file, and hopefully next week we can get into this a little further. Second music break. I haven't indulged in my Irish musical addiction for a while, so this is The Corrs. Now we get into the firmly serious portion of the show. This is from Charles in Ohio. Dear Mr. Covington, I would like to hear a lot more about the proposed organization of the Northwest Volunteers. I find the concept of a genuine racial elite of political soldiers to be intriguing. Okay, Charles, but before we do, I want to digress a bit onto something else, which may sound completely off topic, but there is a point, and it involves your question, so please bear with me. And by the way, this is going to be one of those areas where people are going to start emailing me and saying, no, Harold, you mustn't talk about things like this. Anywhere the enemy can monitor you, they're listening. And my response to that is, look, there are things that we have to talk about. I have a largely movement-oriented audience thus far, and they need to hear this. They need to think about what I'm saying. And my attitude right now is that the urgency of this subject is such that I just have to say what has to be said, and if Mark Potok or the FBI or the ADL or whoever overhear it, then they hear it. To hell with them. One of the reasons that I refuse to become a fearless leader again for so many, many years is that in some respects, it's like trying to run a kindergarten. You're constantly called upon to try and mediate these incredibly childish disputes between your friends and associates, and it gets to the point where you're ready to start tearing your hair out. I call this phenomenon by several names, such as Goo Boo and Space Madness after the Ren and Stimpy episode, which I'm sure you can find on YouTube somewhere. Now, the internet has accelerated this tendency to the point of true gibbering lunacy in some cases. You may have heard of the fabled fountain of youth. Well, the internet seems to contain a fountain of childishness, which is not the same thing. Even as new as we are, and as small as our little circle is so far, I am already being confronted by demands from some of our people that I take their side in some bizarre, pointless little dispute they're having, almost always on the internet, with somebody else in the group. And by take their side, I'm supposed to read the naughty person out from the altar, so to speak, exorcise them with bell, book, and candle, and cast them into outer darkness in the manner of Matt Cale. Guys, let's go over this all again. Some of you don't seem to get it. I cannot cast anybody into outer darkness. I can't expel anybody from the Northwest Front. There is no Northwest Front. It is a movement, or rather will be one day, not a hierarchy. An organism, not an organization, remember? The Northwest Imperative is not a party or an organized group. It's not Harold Covington or the Northwest Novels or any one man or group of people. It is an idea. An idea, I might add, which I did not invent, and I've never made that claim. Just as the FBI can't infiltrate an idea or frame an idea on the perjured testimony of an informer, neither can anyone be expelled or excommunicated from an idea. The Northwest American Republic lives in the hearts and minds of the people who believe in it, and no imperial decree from me or anybody else can rip that out of someone. They can only kill it themselves, within themselves, through their own confusion and despair. I have no official position in all this. I'm not General Secretary or Chief Cook and Bottle Washer. I'm not Grand Panjandrum or Emperor of the North. That last is Lee Marvin's title. Right now, I'm a spokesman, but that's largely because no one else is willing to step up and serve that function. Hint, hint. We need about a dozen versions of me doing what I'm doing. It's true that as the author of the Northwest Novels and the guy who is doing the most of the heavy lifting right now, I do have a small amount of moral authority, but I have to be very careful what I attempt to do with it, because it is as nebulous as a morning mist and it can burn away just as quickly. Ambrose Bierce defined influence as something you think you have until you try to use it. If I were to start barking orders like a drill sergeant and issuing fatwas or whatever, the fact is that I have no way to enforce it. I'm not an employer, and I'm not signing paychecks, which is the only authority Americans recognize, that of money. If I ever get to the point where I'm like William Pierce and I am actually employing people and signing paychecks, then I can start giving orders and firing people. But that time is nowhere near visible anywhere in the future. So, guys, please, quit sending me these emails demanding that I take sides with you against somebody else who's doing something you don't like on the internet. If you come across some genuine evidence that someone associated with us is doing something they shouldn't, like shooting heroin or molesting animals in the zoo, or if you see one of our guys coming out of a synagogue or the FBI offices, yeah, then let me know. But as to all this infantile, he said, she said, you said, I said, they said, goo-boo off the goddamned internet, take it outside. Take it onto VNN, or take it onto some obscure Yahoo group with 8 members, or better yet, take it back onto Usenet and just scream abuse at each other all you want. Now, to wash all that negativity away, third music break. Time for something a little down home, I think. This will be the third song from Steve Earle I played on this show. I'll get him to sue me yet. Thank you.
Well, my name's John Lee Pettimore. Same as my daddy has daddied before. You hardly ever saw granddaddy down here. He only come a town about twice a year. You buy 100 pounds of yeast and some copper line. Everybody knew that it made moonshine. Now the revenue man wanted granddaddy bad. He'd left a holler of everything he had. For my time, but I've been told never come back from Copperhead Road. In a big black Dodge, bought it at an auction at the Mason's Lodge. Johnson County Sheriff painted on the side. Just shot a coat of primer and looked inside. Well, him and my uncle tore that engine down. I still remember that rumbling sound. Then the sheriff came around in the middle of the night. Heard mama crying that something wasn't right. He's headed down to Knoxville with a weekly load. You can smell a whiskey burning down Copperhead Road.
Okay, getting back to Charles's question. Now, this is going to sound a little bit contradictory, but bear with me. I think if you try to follow me, you can pick up on what I'm saying here. Now, what I just said about the Northwest Front being an organism and not an organization and so on, don't get me wrong. All of that is perfectly true as far as it goes. All of that having been said, someday it's going to have to change. And this is where the Northwest Volunteers come in. I have described the Northwest Front as an organism and not an organization, as a binding together of all the strands of the movement, as disparate groups of people marching separately but striking together, all very loosey-goosey, no formal membership, no hierarchy, so forth and so on. And I mean it. It has to be that way. Note what I say here, not that it should be that way, but that it has to be that way. Why does it have to be that way? Because we are dealing with white Americans, and white Americans are incapable of doing anything else. They are incapable of self-discipline. Most will accept only the external discipline of money and the workplace, and precious little of that. The American work ethic notoriously sucks. White Americans have been conditioned from birth by the Jews to be completely narcissistic consumer animals who will not tolerate any attempt to control or restrain their impulses or their appetites. They will reject any force or idea which seeks to impose order and purpose on their self-centered, disorderly, and dysfunctional lives. Now, this is one of the main reasons that the United States military has so many washouts who never make it past basic training. I think it's best summed up, appropriately enough, by a slogan from a bird-brained television show that has become an American mantra. You're not the boss of me. The problem is that if there is ever to be any real change, and if our race is to survive, as in continue to exist, then somebody has damn well got to be the boss of you. I have described the Northwest Front as it must be, given the times and given the human material that we have to work with. I didn't say I liked it, and I didn't say it would win. What our race desperately, frantically needs is a fighting revolutionary party of fanatical political soldiers working under an iron code of total and complete dedication to the 14 words to the exclusion of all else. The party we need should combine the racial ideals and moral clarity of Hitler's National Socialists, the discipline and the organization of Lenin's Bolsheviks, and the courage and daring of the IRA. I am not asking you to give me that party. I long ago accepted that I'm not going to get it. Through no fault of your own, with no blame attached to you, the tragic and brutal fact is that you are incapable of it. If nothing else, this is proven by the fact that 8 years after I myself came home, I am still not seeing those out-of-state license plates coming over the hill. Now let's cut right down to the bone, as close to the bone as it gets. If you are not capable of committing a simple, doable, perfectly legal act of faith, such as coming to the homeland, an act which is in fact to your own personal benefit in the long run, an act which almost all of you would do next week if you were only paid money, if you can't or won't even pack a moving van, then you're not capable of forming an organized and disciplined party and army of white revolutionaries. Before the Civil War, in slavery times, the niggers had their underground railroad that led north to freedom, so that they could work in mills and factories for 50 cents a day instead of chop cotton on a plantation. I wouldn't call that freedom, but some of them did. Anyway, in those days, the nigger slaves had a folk saying as to how to find their way north. They said, "The moss always grows on the north side of the tree." Our people's road to freedom lies northwest, and we don't need to know about moss because we don't need an underground railroad to take us to our homeland. It's here, waiting for us. And yet most of you hang your heads and shuffle your feet and make your excuses, and you will not take the freedom road. I'm not ragging on you. I'm not trying to humiliate you or insult you. I'm not trying to shame you into doing the right thing, although I can't say as I'd be unhappy if it did have that effect on someone. I say again, this is not your fault. It is the fault of the Jews who took away your manhood and made you what you are. Nobody is blaming you, least of all me. We have to play the cards we're dealt. But the simple fact remains, I have come to accept that almost none of you are emotionally or spiritually capable of responding to this deadly urgent crisis of civilization in the way that I ask of you. Almost none of you. I refuse to accept that I am the last of my kind. I refuse to accept that nowhere out there are there any more like me. I know that somewhere within the sound of my voice there are at least a few of you who have somehow managed to walk through the Jewish plague uncontaminated and untouched. A tiny handful of you who carry within your souls the old stuff, the right stuff. True, most of you who do have the old stuff, the right stuff within you, are my own age or older. But we are not the last. Somewhere out in the chaos and the madness and the despair of Obama's America, there are young white men and women in their 30s, in their 20s, in their teens, who still have that hero gene in their makeup, that spark that allows for the lone wolf to survive in the forest away from the pack, that sliver of steel in their spine that makes a real man, a white man. One day, one of you other guys will be diddling away on your computers, chomping down on your nachos and sucking down your cold brew, and you will casually post to some bulletin board or some comments section on a blog, and without ever knowing it, you'll get a hit. Some young man or woman, 19 or 20, one of the last of the alpha whites, will see your post and follow it up and find that party website. One day, somehow, these few remaining alphas will find us. One day they will come to us. For every 99 of you sitting in New York and Wisconsin and Florida and Oklahoma who pause and shuffle and hang your heads and mumble excuses about jobs and college courses when I speak of homecoming, for every one of you who finds that lifting the cardboard boxes into the moving van or the U-Haul trailer is a task beyond your strength, there is one young man or woman who will leap to that task with fire in their blood and hope in their eyes, who, once they understand, cannot wait to take the road northwest. Charles, those are our Northwest volunteers. Those will be the ones who do the heavy lifting, the ones who understand that before they fight and die for the homeland, they must first work for it. Those are the ones who will not run away from discipline, organization, and responsibility like Americans do, but who will run towards it like white men do. Yes, they are the ones who, some dark and foggy night, in someone's home in Washington, or in a motel in Montana, or in a barn in Oregon, will take the oath to the Northwest American Republic in front of the tricolor banner and a small gathering of loyal comrades. Those are the ones who will live for freedom in a new land, and who, when the time comes, will fight and die for it. They are there. They exist. We will find them, or they will find us, and they will come. And when the rest of you see them coming and hear of their deeds here in this land that God and destiny has appointed for our people, you too will finally find the strength to pack that moving van and follow them. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andenban. Freedom.